Welcome to the SGO podcast on immunotherapy. My name is Karen Shi, and I'm a gynecologic oncologist and assistant professor at Northwell Health Hofstra Medical School in Long Island, New York. This is part two of our ongoing series in immunotherapy toxicity. In today's session, we're going to be discussing common controversies in immunotherapy. I'm joined again by two guests, Dr. Erin Zaholsky and Dr. Sarah Hayward. Welcome, ladies.
Glad to be back this afternoon. My name is Sarah Hayward. I am a clinical pharmacy specialist at the University of Oklahoma Health Science Center, Stevenson Cancer Center, and I work with the gynecologic oncology group in their clinic.
Great to be back again as well. My name is Erin Zaholsky. I'm an assistant professor at Virginia Commonwealth University School of Pharmacy with a practice site in our GYN oncology clinic here in Richmond, Virginia.
Thanks so much for joining us today for a discussion. As you recall, in part one of this series, we discussed the basics of immune-related adverse events. Today, we'll be discussing common controversies of immunotherapy. So in part one, we discussed the use of corticosteroids in the management of immunotherapy-related adverse events. What other options are there beyond corticosteroids?
That's a great question, and there certainly are options. One of the things that I want to bring up, I'm going to talk about assorted ones here today. One of the things that I do want to remind everybody of that we learned in our first session was the acronym LIGS, if we remember. That's going to be my focus for additional therapies beyond corticosteroids. And if we remember, LIGS stands for L is liver and lungs, E endocrine, G gastrointestinal, and S skin. So first things first, the best thing you can do, refer to guidelines. Both ASCO and NCCN have options for treatment of adverse events beyond the use of corticosteroids, or if those steroids are not effective or working for assorted disease sites. It's very important that you refer to these guidelines as there can be updates regularly. And also some things to know is generally across the board, when we're using these additional therapies, we're not necessarily replacing high-dose steroids, but we are using them supplemental to them. So the steroids carry on, and then we add these agents. You're going to recognize a lot of the names of these agents as we go through them. These are medications that are already FDA approved for use in a lot of autoimmune disorders that are specific to these disease sites. So let's first start with skin. So in regards to the maculopapular rash, which is probably our most common side effect when we talk about skin toxicities, there really isn't a whole lot beyond steroids. At this point in time, you've already involved dermatology. They might have some additional recommendations based on their expertise, but per guidelines, there's not a whole lot else to do. When we get to pruritus or just itching, and this is without the presence of a rash, we have a couple of options. We have the addition of gabapentin or pregabalin. A lot of us are familiar with these agents. We also have some medications that we use in the setting of asthma or atopic dermatitis. This includes medications like dupilumab, which is an IL-4 inhibitor, or omalizumab, also known as Xolair, which inhibits IgE on mast cells and basophils. We also have the option of phototherapy. Beyond that, we're going to get into some more serious skin conditions like bullous dermatitis, SGS, TENS. These are going to be very involved, complex cases. Your patient's going to be inpatient, receiving intense care. But options here are going to include medications like rituximab, CD20 inhibitor, and immunosuppressant agent. You can do intravenous immune globulin. And then we also have the option of cyclosporin as well. We're going to move on to our gastrointestinal tract, colitis specifically. So we have our steroids, we have ruled out an infectious source. What are our other options? Our two more common options are going to be infliximab and vedolizumab. Infliximab, a lot of us have heard of, the brand name Remicade. It's a TNF-alpha inhibitor, often used in things like rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis. And then we also have vedolizumab, which is medication helps to prevent and inhibit the migration of memory T lymphocytes across the endothelium into the inflamed GI tissue, FDA approved currently for Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. If we do not have success with high-dose steroids, in addition to these agents, there are also medications you can look in guidelines for if they are refractory. These particular medications, generally patients receive as three dose series. So a baseline dose, 2 weeks out, and then 6 weeks out. This is the same dosing for the FDA indications for these two medications as well. Next, we're going to move on to endocrine. There really isn't a lot in the realm of immunosuppressants, aside from if we're supplementing something that the body already needs. A lot of this is symptomatic management, the same as we would the primary disease. For example, a patient now has hypothyroidism, thyroid replacement. Hypophysitis, we're going to use corticosteroids for that adrenal insufficiency. Patients with hyperglycemia, or who we have worsened their diabetes, induced diabetes, might require insulin management at this point in time. Moving on to the liver. Again, we've tried our high-dose steroids. We have ruled out an infectious source. We have involved a hepatologist, not to be confused with a herpetologist. Erin, do you know what a herpetologist does?
I can't say I do.
I caught you off guard there, didn't I? They study amphibians. Anywho, it's always something I think about. But a hepatologist has been involved. Here is a case where we cannot use all the medication across all disease sites. Infliximab is actually contraindicated in the use of hepatotoxicity associated with immune checkpoint inhibitors because of the possibility of drug-induced liver injury. We have the options of mycophenolate, which is an immunosuppressant that we already use in the setting of solid organ transplant or perhaps graft versus host in patients with bone marrow transplant. This is also used not in cardiac, renal, and pulmonary related adverse events associated with immune checkpoint inhibitors. If we do not have success with mycophenolate, we have tacrolimus or tacrolimus, depending on how you say, potato, potato. This is important. If patients are started on this medication, we do monitor renal function and drug levels. And then pulmonary toxicity. Again, we have tried our high-dose steroids. We have ruled out infectious sources. The options here, there's really no data to support one over the other. This could be infliximab, like we saw with colitis, intravenous immunoglobulin, mycophenolate, or even cyclophosphamide. Yes, cyclophosphamide, the chemotherapy agent, can be used as well. So that's the quick overview. Erin, any additions that you can think of to this big long list?
That was quite thorough.
Yeah.
I agree. That was very complete. I think it's interesting how there's not one second line option to steroids. Our options vary pretty widely depending on what immune-related adverse event is occurring. It also stretches our knowledge to remember back to rheumatology because there is, as you mentioned, Sarah, a lot of overlap in treatment of those disease states.
So once a patient has experienced an immune-related adverse event, how can it be determined if rechallenge is appropriate?
Another great question that comes up on a day-to-day basis in clinic. So as far as a patient who's experienced an immune-related adverse event being rechallenged and experiencing another one, our pharmacovigilance and retrospective studies tell us that recurrence rates are around 30 to 50%. And that colitis, hepatitis, and pneumonitis are actually the most likely to recur. We also need to remember that their recurrence rates are going to be higher with our CTLA-4 monoclonal antibodies, as opposed to the PD-L1, PD-1 agents. And if you need a refresher on what those are, go back and listen to part one of the podcast. So clinically making this decision, it's nuanced and multifactorial, and it's going to depend on the patient in front of you. It's based on factors like previous tumor response to immunotherapy, how long they were on treatment, then of course the type and severity of the toxicity, time to toxicity resolution, and of course the availability of alternate therapies for treatment of their cancer. And as far as a patient achieving a previous response to the therapy for their cancer, if a response is achieved, there's actually a likelihood that that response will be durable from what we know, mostly from studies in other cancers like non-small cell lung cancer. So if they've achieved a good response, you actually could reasonably consider not restarting that immunotherapy or rechallenging, especially if the toxicity was severe. Whereas if the response has not been achieved in the setting of few good alternative therapies, rechallenge may be more reasonable when looking at a risk versus benefit decision. In general, the textbook answer to this question is in patients who experience immune-related adverse events that are grade 3 or less, can be considered for rechallenge with immunotherapy once their symptoms improve to grade 1 or less. Of course, we're going to pay extra caution to toxicities that occur in vital organs. So neuromuscular toxicities, cardiac, immune-related adverse events, because there is really no data on the safety of rechallenge in those life-threatening settings. One note I wanted to point out when considering rechallenge in oncology with chemotherapy, we may have the inclination to do a dose adjustment or a reduction, but that is not going to be the case with immunotherapy. If a patient experiences a grade 4 immune-related adverse event, generally we are going to discontinue and not consider a rechallenge, except for toxicities like endocrinopathies that have been corrected with hormone replacement.
So what do you think about rechallenging with an alternative immunotherapy agent?
My opinion, and Sarah, please chime in too, is we should not rechallenge with an alternative immunotherapy agent. That T cell activation and resultant immune-related adverse effect is a pharmacodynamic effect, and this happens with all immune checkpoint inhibitors. I would say the only time that this would be appropriate is in the case of infusion-related reactions, because the frequency of infusion-related reactions is higher with some of the immune checkpoint inhibitors like avelumab than others. Maybe the other situation is if patients are receiving a combination CTLA-4 inhibitor and a PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitor, we may simply resume the PD-L1, PD-L1 inhibitor and not the CTLA-4.
Yeah, and in general, Erin, I absolutely agree with the answers. My answer might be a maybe. You will find case reports out there, not necessarily in the setting of gynecologic malignancies, but I have seen them for other malignancies where transitioning from one particular PD-1 to another or PD-1 to a PD-L1, patients seem to retain benefit of the immune checkpoint inhibitor treatment without recurrence of the offending side effect. But that is, you know, very, very patient specific. We only had the incidents where we tried to do it for a hypersensitivity reaction. But like you said, that just makes a lot more sense in that particular setting.
I think it is interesting, and I'll be watching the evidence as well. You also have to think, if you rechallenge that same patient with the same immunotherapy, would they don't always have a recurrence, right? So did it really help prevent that? Or did they just get lucky?
All interesting points. To change gears a little bit, and this comes up a lot in clinical practice, how do you guys feel about patients with autoimmune conditions? Can they safely receive immunotherapy?
The short answer is yes, they can. There is no contraindication to patients with autoimmune conditions receiving immune checkpoint inhibitors. It just has to be a bigger discussion, multidisciplinary team approach. It has to be specific to that patient, to that patient's condition, making sure that we discuss risks and benefits with the patient and with their rheumatologist. So this is all very important. We don't have tons of data because oftentimes these patients were excluded from clinical trials due to presumed risk of increased immune-related adverse events or possibly exacerbation of their pre-existing autoimmune disease. There is currently a phase 1 trial, a prospective trial looking at nivolumab in patients with autoimmune disorders for advanced, recurrent, and metastatic cancers. Aside from that, most of our data is retrospective reports. Overall, they show that these patients have comparable and, on occasion, greater efficacy compared to the general population and have similar or maybe slightly higher rates of immune-related adverse events compared to the general population. The negative about these particular retrospective reports is that they're looking at the patients in aggregate, so they lump everybody together. Should we be approaching a patient with rheumatoid arthritis differently than we approach a patient with ulcerative colitis? We don't know the answer to that. Overall flare rates varied across these studies, anywhere from 11 to 55%. In the end, it just requires multidisciplinary team approach, making sure everybody's aware and having a high level of suspicion for when this patient or if this patient starts to have side effects and do we think they're related to their immunotherapy.
What do you guys think about the influence of medications and their dosing on immunotherapy effectiveness, such as steroids?
This has been a big question since the popularity and expansive use of immunotherapies have affected patients with cancer. there have been multiple studies looking at the influence of other medications, particularly steroids. And the basis of this controversy makes sense. Immune checkpoint inhibitors require an intact, robust immune response. So the immunosuppressive properties of steroids raise concern of interfering with the anti-tumor response. Furthermore, most of our clinical trials exclude patients who are on corticosteroid doses of greater than 10 milligrams per day. So what does this data tell us? Existing data of the effect of systemic steroids on immunotherapy efficacy remain unclear, mostly because the indication for steroid use, the dose of the steroid, the duration of the steroid, and the timing at which patients receive steroids in relation to starting immunotherapy varies so greatly. So I'll start out with, what about use of steroids in treating these immune-related adverse events that we've talked so extensively about? So from what we know, steroids to treat immune-related adverse events do not negate their therapeutic benefit. But this could be due to a correlation between immune-related adverse events and response and survival. So to learn more about that factor, stay tuned for our next episode of this podcast. Sarah, what do you think about steroid use as pre-medications for immunotherapy?
I think that yes, you can use them and the data is there to support it. You can use corticosteroids as a pre-medication regimen. Generally, this is going to be dexamethasone for the majority of us. And this can be used not only as an antiemetic, but also for the prevention of hypersensitivity reactions. The data that sort of led us to this conclusion is from non-small cell lung cancer. In looking at treating patients with a platinum doublet with or without a PD-1 inhibitor, in this particular case, pembrolizumab, patients all received dexamethasone as one of their premeds. In the end, we saw superior efficacy in the pembro-containing arms. In our particular setting of gynecologic malignancies, we can say the same holds true for GY018, right? We treated patients with Taxol and Carbo, and they received Pembro or they did not. The actual protocol states that the patients should get dexamethasone in an effort to prevent hypersensitivity reactions to their taxane. So yeah, absolutely you can. Personally, when we also think about guidelines for antiemetics in the setting of chemotherapy, I do try to avoid the day 2 through 4 oral dexamethasone after chemotherapy, if at all possible, because we do have other oral options or breakthrough options in that particular patient population and sort of and use it as a last resort if need be. Makes the providers and the patients feel more comfortable because they all get scared when they think about steroids and immune checkpoint inhibitors together. But just that's the way that we approach our particular patient population. What about you guys?
We are definitely feel comfortable using corticosteroids as pre-medications when a patient's receiving, you know, a drug that causes a hypersensitivity reaction or has a moderate to high risk of nausea and vomiting. I can't say that we've modified our consecutive day antiemetics, but it's a good thought. The next kind of group of patients on steroids that I think about are patients who receive aggressive steroids as management for other oncologic complications or conditions. So for example, patients with spinal cord compression from their tumor, a primary or metastatic brain cancer causing cerebral edema, cancer-related cachexia. These are patients receiving longer term, generally higher dose steroids. And a lot of these patients have been evaluated in the studies looking at the effect of steroids on immunotherapy. And what these studies have shown is that patients on steroids actually do have worse outcomes and worse survival. But I ask the question here, is this because of the influence on immunotherapy efficacy? Or is this because these patients generally have a poor prognosis if they have some of these really extensive life-altering symptomatic conditions? There have been some studies looking at the timing of steroids as well. So a recent study that was published in the Journal for Immunotherapy and Cancer in 2021 by Maslov and colleagues found that patients initiating steroids greater than or equal to 2 months after initiation of their checkpoint inhibitor had a significantly improved progression-free survival and overall survival compared with patients who had earlier corticosteroid initiation, so less than 2 months. So that shows us that the timing of steroids also may play a role. You will also see many other medications being looked at for their influence on immunotherapy. I think two kind of interesting groups are antibiotics and probiotics. There is some evidence out there that altering the intestinal microbiome influences the immune system. And that evidence kind of showing us that there are differences in the microbiome of patients who respond to immunotherapy versus patients that don't respond. So you would start to think about the effect of antibiotics and probiotics here. Notably, there are some small studies indicating that antibiotics used to treat infections within a month of starting an immune checkpoint inhibitor could reduce response and survival. Another group of medications that you'll see or substances is medical marijuana. So medical marijuana has also been shown in small retrospective studies to perhaps reduce response. My thoughts here with antibiotics, probiotics, and medical marijuana is that it likely won't change how we manage patients and their symptoms and their needs, but it is certainly thought-provoking.
Yeah, it just seems like there's not enough data to really, you know, have a conclusion in terms of their use in that situation. So this was a lot of information we covered today. Hopefully it was informative for you as for everyone, as well as for me, touching on many of the controversies in immunotherapy. Thank you so much, Dr. Zahovsky and Dr. Hayward, for joining me today. Stay tuned for part three of our series, where we'll be touching on other controversies in immunotherapy and then also discussing some broader clinical questions.
Thank you, Dr. Shi.
Thank you.
The information presented is that of the contributing faculty and presenters and does not necessarily represent the views of the Society of Gynecologic Oncology or any named company or organization providing financial support. Specific therapies discussed may not be approved and/or specified for use as indicated by the faculty or presenters. If you like what you heard today, please let us know by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and hitting the follow button wherever you're listening. If you have suggestions for future SGO On the Go podcasts, please email us at education@sgo.org.